Hi, everybody. Thanks for coming. The turnout looks great from up here. The recent assault on Gaza has shown us all the need for wider context and understanding the Israel-Palestine conflict. Israel was able, over the last month, to unfold a long-planned, long-fostered campaign of delegitimization and dehumanization of the Palestinian people and their representatives, which allowed the human toll, the devastating human toll on the ground in Gaza, to unfold without the so-called international community stepping in. It's important to understand that this propaganda campaign, one of the most important weapons in combating it is our guest tonight, Dr. Finkelstein. Dr. Finkelstein is often characterized as controversial. In fact, you rarely see anything but that word attached to his name. But the term controversial is actually used as a tool for obfuscation and to really detract from what Dr. Finkelstein really is, which is a standard throwback scholar, meticulous, forensic, and impeccable, who studies not secret documents hidden in deep archives, but rather widely available public record of Israel's human rights violations in the occupied territories in particular. In many ways, Dr. Finkelstein's career mirrors the struggle for Palestine that took place, that has taken place in the media and on campuses throughout North America and in many cases throughout the world. As a graduate student, Dr. Finkelstein chose in the early 1980s, at a time when Palestinians were fighting just to be called Palestinians in Canada. It wasn't until the mid-1980s that we began calling Palestinians by their proper name and not just generally Arabs. At that time, Dr. Finkelstein chose to take on a widely praised book of demography, which conveniently showed that the Palestinians, in fact, did not exist and were just visitors in the land that was Greater Israel. So for the younger in the audience, if Joan Peters is unknown today and her work not on your syllabus, in many ways we have only Dr. Finkelstein to thank for that. His most recent topic in his book, Beyond Chutzpah, has been framed as a scholarly debate between a Harvard professor and Dr. Finkelstein. But what it is, in fact, Beyond Chutzpah, is, as Dr. Chomsky called it, the best compendium that now exists of Israel's human rights violations and the blocking of diplomacy by Israel and the United States. Now, if Joan Peters' book has been disappeared from history, perhaps we can hope that the next generation in this audience dealing with Palestinians 20 years from now will only know Alan Dershowitz not as a hysterical defender of Israel's atrocities, but only as OJ's lawyer. So we'll see if that can in fact unfold. And if Dr. Finkelstein's career does mirror the struggle for truth in the Palestinian arena, the fact that Israel groups at UBC host Israeli generals with 20 people in the audience, and Dr. Finkelstein is lecturing in front of 600 or 800 people, I think that gives people a subtle and encouraging sign of just who's winning this struggle in the long run. So, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Dr. Finkelstein.
So I was originally going to speak on Gandhi this evening, and I had a substantial lecture prepared on the topic, but I decided it just wouldn't be the appropriate occasion because most of you are here to find out about or have been stimulated to come here because of the events in Gaza, and it seems to me my obligation now or responsibility is to respond to what's happened in the past couple of weeks. And so I'll be focusing this evening on the events in Gaza, but I'll be happy during questions and answers to bring in Gandhi and my own impressions of where what he has to say is relevant or applicable to what's happening in the occupied territories. What I want to speak about this evening is the background to the Gaza massacre. I'm not trying to use that language for its incendiary value, but I don't think it can be properly described as a war when the ratio of those killed is 100-1 by any reasonable standard. What we witnessed in the past couple of weeks was a massacre or a slaughter. It can't reasonably be called a war, if by war we mean an exchange of fighting between two sides. So I will be referring to it as a massacre, a bloodbath, a slaughter, however it works into my remarks. When the war first began, when the massacre first began, there was a lot of speculation that it had to do with the upcoming Israeli election. I didn't think that was the case. I didn't think that was the case then, and I don't think now it was the case. There's a very good Israeli correspondent in the occupied territories named Gideon Levy, and he said at the very beginning of the events in Gaza, he said that Israel went through a very similar war 2.5 years ago in Lebanon when there were no elections. And I think that's an accurate statement. What happened in Gaza in many ways was the aftermath or the natural aftermath of what happened in Lebanon in 2006. And I'll get to that presently. It is true, and one shouldn't deny it, that there were some electoral considerations in what happened in Gaza. Israel is a Spartan-like society. It's consumed by revenge and bloodlust. Killing Arabs is a sure crowd pleaser. And the opinion polls show that during the duration of the attack on Gaza, about 90% of the Israelis supported it. And so those who sought re-election, not unsurprisingly, would think of killing Arabs as a way to garner votes. But the fact is the Israeli leadership is genuinely quite responsible in the sense that it wouldn't sacrifice crucial state interests for the sake of an election. And where major state interests are at stake, the Israeli leaders would not conduct a major operation just for the sake of votes. That's not the way that society functions. There have been cases in 1981 when the Prime Minister of Israel, Menachem Begin, he blew up the Ozarek reactor in Iraq, but when he did it, there were no real state interests at stake. Contrary to widespread belief, Saddam Hussein was not at that point in the process of making nuclear weapons. So, what were the main reasons for Israel's attack on Gaza? In my opinion, there were basically two reasons for the attack. First of all, to restore what Israel calls its deterrence capacity, a technical term. This is not working. It's fading in and out. All right. It is fine? Okay. Maybe just because I'm so close. Okay. To restore what it calls its deterrence capacity, a technical term basically meaning restoring the Arab world's fear of Israel. That was its first goal. And secondly, to turn back the Palestinian peace offensive that had been launched by Hamas the past couple of years. Let me look at those goals or aims of the Israeli attack in order. The main New York Times correspondent in the occupied territories and in Israel, a fellow named Ethan Bronner, He wrote that Israel's larger concern in the war, using his words, was to reestablish Israeli deterrence because Israel's enemies are less afraid of it than they once were or than they should be. And this notion of preserving your or Israel's deterrence capacity has always loomed very large in Israeli military doctrine. So let's take the case of how the whole saga of Israel and Gaza began, namely the June 1967 war. It was the climax of that war when Israel occupied the West Bank, Gaza, and assorted other territories, which won't concern us this evening. Now, it's often said that Israel went to war in June 1967 because of the blockade that the Egyptian President Nasser imposed on the Straits of Tehran and because Israel's survival was at stake. But neither of those claims are factually true. It is correct that Mr. Nasser, or President Nasser, imposed a blockade on the Straits of Tehran after Israel laid plans and boasted about its aim to attack Syria. But the blockade that Nasser imposed was actually not very significant. Israel had very little trade going through the Straits of Tehran. And in fact, and what's little known, after a few days, Nasser was letting boats pass through the straits. In fact, there was no blockade of the Straits of Tehran. Israel also claimed, apart from the blockade, which, as I said, actually didn't exist, there was the threat to Israel's survival. But there's no evidence that the Israeli leaders ever felt a threat from Nasser or the neighboring Arab states. How do we know this? Well, there's a fairly extensive documentary record on the topic. Beginning in May 1967, all the U.S. intelligence agencies were testing the prospects and possibilities of an attack by Egypt on Israel. And they kept using the information that was provided by Israel. And each time, the intelligence agencies kept coming back with the same conclusions. Number one, that Egypt was not going to attack. And number two, if Egypt did attack, then Israel, and now I'm quoting Lyndon Baines Johnson, the president at the time, he said, according to all of our intelligence, if Egypt were to attack, in collusion with all the other Arab states, according to our intelligence, said President Johnson, you would, and now I'm quoting him, you would whip the hell out of them. That was the conclusion of the U.S. intelligence agencies. Well, what did the Israelis believe? It happened that the head of Israeli intelligence was in Washington at the time, and he said to the Americans, and now I'm quoting him, he said that there are no differences between the U.S. and the Israelis on the military intelligence picture or its interpretation. That is to say, in June 1967, Israel agreed with the United States. Nasser was not going to attack, and if he did, and even if he did with neighboring Arab states, the Israelis would whip the hell out of them. Well, then why did Israel launch its first strike in June 1967? The reason is fairly straightforward. Nasser was this radical nationalist, and he was defying Israel. And he made all of these defiant gestures in June or in May 1967. So he had to be cut down to size. He had to be reminded who is in charge in the Middle East. At that time, Ariel Sharon was a divisional commander, and he said, "We have to attack." Why? Because Nasser is getting out of hand. We are losing our deterrence capacity, our main weapon, the fear of us. The Arabs were not afraid of us. And so we have to cut them down to size. One of the leading Israeli historians in the topic, a fellow named Ze'ev Ma'oz, he said the reason Israel attacked in June 1967 was to restore the credibility of Israeli deterrence, to restore the deterrence capacity, to restore the Arab world's fear of Israel, to remind the Arab world who is in charge. Israel is in charge. That was 1967, when the problem begins with the occupied territories. And now if we move up to the year 2000, Israel faces another threat to its deterrence capacity. Those Arabs are getting out of hand again. They're getting too uppity. So in May 2000, after an 18-year-long guerrilla war, the Hezbollah expels Israel's occupying army from South Lebanon. Israel suffers a humiliating defeat, and it's a defeat which is celebrated throughout the Arab world. Immediately after suffering its defeat in May 2000, Israel begins preparing for another war against the Hezbollah. They have to restore their deterrence capacity. They have to restore the Arab world's fear of Israel. In summer 2006, Israel finds its pretext and it unleashes the fury of its air force and prepares a ground invasion against the Hezbollah. But alas, it suffers yet another ignominious defeat. In fact, it was a defeat of colossal dimensions. A respected American military analyst, partial to Israel, but nonetheless he concludes, and now I'm quoting him, "The Israeli Air Force, the arm of the Israeli military that had once destroyed whole air forces in a few days," referring to the June 67 war, "not only proved unable to stop Hezbollah rocket strikes, but even to do enough damage to prevent Hezbollah's rapid recovery. Once Israel's ground troops crossed into Lebanon, they failed to overtake Hezbollah's strongholds, even those close to the border." If you look at some basic figures, you get a sense of how big the defeat was that Israel suffered. Israel deployed 30,000 troops in Lebanon on the eve of the war. The total number of Hezbollah fighters and irregular Hezbollah forces totaled 6,000. Israel delivered and fired 162,000 weapons against Lebanon. Hezbollah fired 5,000 weapons. The number of weapons Hezbollah fired for the whole duration of the war, Israel fired each day of the war for 34 days. And in fact, Israel never even fought the main Hezbollah army, the crack Hezbollah troops were stationed along the Litani River waiting for the Israeli invasion that never happened. Israelis were very upset by the defeat they suffered in 2006. And they were itching for another war against the Hezbollah. From their point of view, they were not down. They were down, but they were not yet out. They wanted another crack at the Hezbollah. But they didn't yet have a military option. In mid-2008, they desperately sought to conscript the United States for an attack on Iran. They hoped by knocking out Iran, they would also decapitate Hezbollah and then defeat their main challengers in the region. Israel threatened that it was going to use non-conventional weapons, nuclear weapons, if the United States didn't join in the attack on Iran. Well, to Israel's chagrin and humiliation, the United States opted out, Iran went its merry way, and Israel's deterrence capacity, its capacity to terrorize the Arab world into submission, it slipped another notch. It was high time to find a defenseless target to annihilate. Enter Gaza, Israel's favorite shooting gallery. Even there, the feebly armed Islamic movement, Hamas, had defiantly resisted Israeli dictate in June 2008, even compelling Israel to agree to a ceasefire. Well, what was the strategy? What were they going to do in Gaza? It was pretty straightforward. During the 2006 Lebanon War, Israel flattened this area of South Beirut known as the Dahiya. It was a Hezbollah stronghold, a large amount of popular support among the poor in Beirut. I had a chance to visit that area a few months ago. They turned it into a moonscape, where once there were 5- and 6-story apartment dwellings, there was just nothing. And Israel then began to talk about the Dahiya strategy. What was the Dahiya strategy? They said, we shall pulverize the 160,000 Shiite villages in Lebanon that have turned into Shiite army bases. We shall not show mercy when it comes to hitting the national infrastructure of a state that in practice is controlled by Hezbollah. That was the head of the Israeli Army Northern Command. A reserve colonel said, should there be hostilities, we have to act immediately, decisively, and with force that is disproportionate. Such a response aims at inflicting damage and meting out punishment to an extent that will demand long and expensive reconstruction. The Interior Minister said in September 2008, if the Palestinians fire a rocket, the IDF should decide on a neighborhood in Gaza and level it. That's the Dahiya strategy. The operative plan for the Gaza bloodbath can be seen by looking at the authoritative statements released by Israeli officials as the massacre got underway. A reserve major general said, what we have to do is act systematically with the aim of punishing all the organizations that are firing the rockets and mortars, comma, as well as the civilians who are enabling them to fire and hide. The IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces, official spokesman said, anything affiliated with Hamas is a legitimate target. And it was a real success. We can't dispute that. Whereas Israel killed a mere 55 Lebanese during the first 2 days of the Lebanon War in 2006, the Israeli media exulted at Israel's what they called shock and awe as it killed more than 300 Palestinians in the first 2 days of the attack on Gaza. Was it an accident? Several days into the slaughter, an informed Israeli strategic analyst wrote, the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces, which planned to attack buildings and sites populated by hundreds of people, did not warn them in advance to leave, but intended to kill a great many of them, and succeeded. The historian, the sometime historian Benny Morris, the full-time propagandist Benny Morris, he could barely contain his pride at what he called Israel's highly efficient air assault on Hamas. Not everyone in Israel was so impressed. The Israeli columnist B. Michael, he was not very impressed by what he called the dispatch of helicopter gunships and jet planes over a giant prison and firing at its people. Who are these people they were firing at? Gideon Levy says, you may recall those police cadets who were killed on the first and second day, or first or second day. Who were they? Gideon Levy describes them, 70 traffic cops at their graduation ceremony, young men in desperate search of a livelihood who thought they'd found it in the police and instead found death from the skies. As Israel targeted schools, mosques, hospitals, ambulances, UN sanctuaries, as it flattened entire neighborhoods, as it slaughtered and incinerated Gaza's defenseless civilian population, Israeli commentators gloated that, quote, Gaza is to Lebanon as the second sitting for an exam is to the first. A second chance to get it right. And this time, Israel had hurled back Gaza not 20 years, as it promised to do in Lebanon, but into the 1940s. Electricity is available only for a few hours a day. He's so happy. Another commentator, Israel has regained its deterrence capabilities because the war in Gaza has compensated for the shortcomings of the 2006 Lebanon War. Another commentator, there is no doubt that Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah is upset these days. There will no longer be anyone in the Arab world who can claim that Israel is weak. And truly, who can any longer claim that Israel is weak? Who can doubt that it is strong, courageous, heroic? It caged in 1.5 million people, half of whom are under the age of 16. 80% of whom are refugees or sons and daughters of refugees. It built a fence and a wall around them. It then, for 2.5 years, systematically starved them. It then reduced them to abject despair. It then sent in jet planes, helicopter gunships, armored personnel carriers, and tanks. It then sprayed whole neighborhoods with white phosphorus. It achieved the magnificent killing ratio, 100-1. 14 Israelis killed, about 13 or 1400 Palestinians killed. Who can claim that Israel is weak? Who can doubt its courage and heroism? The New York Times foreign affairs expert, Thomas Friedman, he joined in the chorus of hallelujahs. He was thrilled by what Israel was doing. He said, there's a misconception, a widespread misconception. People think Israel lost the war in Lebanon in 2006. Not so, says Mr. Friedman, because Israel inflicted substantial property damage and collateral casualties on Lebanon during the war. It administered an education to Hezbollah. Hezbollah would now think 3 times before defying Israel. And he said he hopes that Israel would likewise educate Hamas by inflicting a heavy death toll on Hamas militants and heavy pain on the Gaza population. Now, it was said that during the war in Lebanon, and Mr. Friedman repeats the claim, that Israel had no choice. These nasty Islamic fundamentalists, these demonic Muslims, they nestled among, or as he puts it, nested among the civilian population. They were embedded in the civilian population. They were intertwined with the civilian population. What choice did Israel have against those demonic forces of Hezbollah? What does the record show? Human Rights Watch, hardly a radical organization, in fact, a quite wretched one, in my opinion, it did an exhaustive study of that Lebanon war. Let me quote to you its main conclusion. We found strong evidence that Hezbollah stored most of its rockets in bunkers and weapon storage facilities located in uninhabited fields and valleys. That in the vast majority of cases, Hezbollah fighters left populated civilian areas as soon as the fighting started. And that Hezbollah fired the vast majority of its rockets from pre-prepared positions outside villages. And again, in all but a few of the cases of civilian deaths we investigated, Hezbollah fighters had not mixed with the civilian population or taken other actions to contribute to the targeting of a particular home or vehicle by Israeli forces. Okay, some of you think, how can you trust that human rights organization? Fair enough. Well then, let's look at the U.S. Army War College study, which was based almost entirely on interviews with Israeli soldiers. What did they find? The key battlefields in the land campaign south of the Litani River were mostly devoid of civilians. And IDF soldiers consistently report, listen, little or no meaningful intermingling of Hezbollah fighters and non-combatants. Nor is there any systematic reporting of Hezbollah using civilians in the combat zone as shields. Bear in mind, that's based on the testimony of the Israeli soldiers. Now, Mr. Friedman also says that demonic, vicious Hezbollah, rather than confronting Israel's army head-on, it fired rockets at Israel's civilian population to provoke Israeli retaliatory strikes, inevitably killing Lebanese civilians and inflaming the Arab world. Is that what happened? We have very extensive evidence of Hezbollah's tactics during its guerrilla war for 18 years between 1982 and 2000. And the record is very clear. Hezbollah never initiated attacks on Israeli civilians. When Israel initiated attacks on civilians in South Lebanon, that's when Hezbollah retaliated, what they called, with some legal justification, belligerent reprisals. And the same thing happened in 2006, when the war began, to the extent it was a war, Israel immediately began targeting civilians in Lebanon. And then the Hezbollah leader Nasrallah said, if Israel attacks our civilians, then we would target Israeli civilians as long as Israel undertakes its aggression without limits or red lines. So what does the record show? If Israel targeted the Lebanese civilian population and infrastructure during the 2006 war, it was not because it had no choice. The Hezbollah fighters were away from the civilian population and infrastructure. It was not because Hezbollah provoked it, because it was Israel that initiated the attacks on civilians. So why did it do it? Because terrorizing the civilian population was a relatively cost-free method, to use Mr. Friedman's words, of education, much to be preferred over fighting a real foe and suffering heavy casualties. In the case of Lebanon, they did successfully terrorize the civilian population, and it's probably true. Hezbollah will now think once, twice, and three times before defying Israel. On the other hand, Israel did not achieve a military victory. In the case of Gaza, it was both able to educate the population by destroying the whole society and murdering about 1,400 of its population, and it was also able in Gaza to achieve, unlike in Lebanon, a military victory. Why? Well, Gideon Levy writes, the fighting in Gaza was war deluxe. Compared with previous wars, it's child's play. Pilots bombing unimpeded, as if on practice runs. Tank and artillery soldiers shelling houses and civilians from their armored vehicles. Combat engineering troops destroying entire streets in their ominous protected vehicles without facing serious opposition. A large, broad army is fighting against a helpless population and a weak, ragged organization that has fled the conflict zones and is barely putting up a fight. So, Israel thinks, imagines, it's restored its deterrence capacity. Beyond doing that, its other main goal, or the other main goal of the Gaza slaughter, was to fend off, to foil, to defeat the threat posed by Palestinian moderation. For the past three decades, the entire international community has agreed on how to resolve the Israel-Palestine conflict. And virtually everybody in this room, I suspect, knows the capsule formula for resolving it. It's called the two-state settlement based on the full Israeli withdrawal from the territories it occupied in June 1967 and a just resolution of the refugee question based on the right of return and compensation. Every year, the vote is the same in the United Nations. This past year, they put forth those terms for resolving the conflict: two states on the June 67 border, resolving the refugee question based on the right of return and compensation. The vote this past year, 2008, it was 164 in favor, 7 against. The whole world on one side, Israel, the United States, Australia, the Marshall Islands, Micronesia, Nauru, and Palau on the other side. You go back to 1989, about 20 years ago. There's a vote on the two-state settlement on the June 67 border in the United Nations General Assembly. The vote, 151-3. The whole world on one side, Israel, the United States, and the island state of Dominica on the other side. You can go through the record, very easy to find. Just go and Google peaceful settlement of the question of Palestine, and you'll see the record for the past two decades. The whole world on one side, Israel backed by the United States, and a few South Sea islands on the other side. Their combined populations can fill the spaces in this room. Beyond, I should note, incidentally, that in the last vote, I didn't check for the past years, among the whole world on one side includes Iran. At the regional level, the Arab League, in March 2002, it put forth a settlement, two states, June 67 border, just resolution of the refugee question. All 22 members of the Arab League approve it. And the Arab League keeps renewing the offer to Israel. You have the whole world as represented in the General Assembly. You now have the main regional organization, the Arab World, putting forth this settlement. Well, things are looking very dire for Israel. They're bordering on a disaster. And now the disaster is full-blown because Hamas signals it too supports a two-state settlement on the June 67 border. I can quote 100 statements just for convenience's sake. I'll quote a recent one from the Hamas, head of the Hamas's political bureau, Khalid Mashal. And he said in March 2008, and I'm quoting him, "There is an opportunity to deal with this conflict in a manner different than Israel, and behind it, the U.S. is dealing with it today. There is an opportunity to achieve a Palestinian national consensus on a political program based on the 1967 borders. And this is an exceptional circumstance in which most Palestinian forces, including Hamas, accept a state on the 1967 borders. There is also an Arab consensus on this demand. This is a historic situation. But, says the leader of Hamas, no one is taking advantage of this opportunity. No one is moving to cooperate with this opportunity. Even this minimum that has been accepted by the Palestinians and the Arabs has been rejected by Israel and by the U.S. So, now we have a full-blown catastrophe. Hamas, too, accepts the two-state settlement. And what's worse, Hamas enters into a ceasefire with Israel in June 2008. And according to Israel's official publication, and now I'm quoting it, this is after the massacre began. Israel's official website, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, posted a publication entitled The Six-Month Lull Arrangement. And now I'm quoting what Israel's official Ministry of Foreign Affairs publication says. Hamas was careful to maintain the ceasefire it entered into with Israel in June 2008. It was careful to maintain the ceasefire despite the fact that Israel reneged on its responsibility, namely easing the blockade around Gaza. The publication continues. The lull, the ceasefire, was sporadically violated by rocket and mortar shell carried out by rogue terrorist organizations. At the same time, Hamas tried to enforce the terms of the arrangement on the other terrorist organizations, and Hamas tried to prevent them from violating it. So now we have a new disaster. Hamas is abiding by the ceasefire. Well, it gets worse. According to the head of the Shin Bet, Israel's internal security organization, agency, Hamas was interested in renewing the ceasefire. Well, now we have a catastrophic development or sequence of developments. Because Israel could no longer justify shunning Hamas. And it would only be a matter of time before international pressure, especially from the Europeans, would be exerted on Israel to negotiate with Hamas. Interestingly, this is not the first time Israel faced such a diabolical threat. An Arab League peace initiative, Palestinian support for a two-state settlement, and a Palestinian ceasefire. And it's not the first time that Israel embarked on provocation and war to overcome this diabolical threat. In the mid-1970s, well before most of you were born, the PLO, the Palestine Liberation Organization, which was headed by a fellow named Yasser Arafat, they came out in support of a two-state settlement. In addition, the PLO, it was headquartered in Lebanon at the time. In June 1981, the PLO entered into, lo and behold, a ceasefire with Israel. So now we have the PLO supporting the two-state settlement, and we have a ceasefire. And then another catastrophe unfolds back then. In 1981, August to be precise, the Saudis put forth a peace plan. And then the Arab League endorses the peace plan. Exactly what happened in the build-up to the current massacre. How did Israel react? The PLO is agreeing to a two-state settlement. The PLO agrees to a ceasefire. The PLO strictly adheres to the ceasefire. The Arab League puts forth a peace plan. It was called back then the Fahd Peace Plan, F-A-H-D, named after, I guess it was King Fahd at the time. How does Israel react? In September 1981, 1 month after the Arab League presents its peace plan, 2 months after the PLO enters into the ceasefire, Israel prepares to destroy the PLO. Why? Let me quote to you from Israel's, he's since passed away, leading strategic analyst, a fellow named Avner Yaniv. He says as follows, Yasser Arafat was contemplating a historic compromise with Israel. But all the Israeli leaders and the main opposition in Israel opposed a full Israeli withdrawal from the West Bank. So what did Israel do? It conducted punitive military raids, listen carefully because it'll sound familiar, deliberately out of proportion against Palestinian and Lebanese civilians. Why did it do that? To weaken PLO moderates, strengthen the hand of radical rivals, and to make sure the PLO is inflexible, that it won't support a two-state settlement. But Yasser Arafat, that demonic, diabolical terrorist, he wouldn't budge. He kept to his word on the ceasefire, and he kept saying he wants a two-state settlement. So Israel only had two choices, says Mr. Yaniv. A political move leading to a historic compromise with the PLO, or preemptive military action against it. Well, what does it do? I like this phrase. Mr. Yaniv says, to prevent Arafat's peace offensive, Israel decided to attack. He says the Israeli invasion had been, quote, preceded by more than a year of effective ceasefire. But then Israel began its murderous provocations, the last of which left as many as 200 civilians dead. That was in May 1982. 60 occupants of a children's hospital were killed. And finally, the PLO retaliated, fired some shells into northern Galilee, and killed one civilian. Now, Israel claimed it was these rocket attacks from Lebanon into the Galilee that caused them to attack Lebanon. But what does Yaniv say? He says the raison d'etre of the entire operation was destroying the PLO as a political force capable of claiming a Palestinian state on the West Bank. It had nothing to do with the shelling of the Northern Galilee. And it had everything to do with the fact that the PLO was too moderate. And Israel did not want to leave the West Bank. Well, fast forward to 2008. In December 2008, Israeli Foreign Minister Tzipi Livni, she says Israel wants a temporary ceasefire, a temporary period of calm with Hamas, but not an extended truce, because an extended truce harms the Israeli strategic goal, empowers Hamas, and gives the impression that Israel recognizes the movement. Translation: a protracted ceasefire that enhanced Hamas's credibility would have undermined Israel's strategic goal of retaining control of the West Bank. So, as far back as March 2007, Israel decides to attack Hamas. It negotiates a truce in June 2008. Why? The Israeli press is very candid. It said Barak, the defense minister, needed time to prepare an attack. Once all the pieces were in place, Israel only lacked a pretext. And on 4 November, while the American media were riveted on election day in the United States, Israel broke the ceasefire by killing 7 Hamas militants on the flimsy excuse that they were digging a tunnel to abduct Israeli soldiers, an excuse that nobody in Israel took seriously. After Hamas predictably resumed its rocket attacks in retaliation, whose phrase is that? It's the same document on the Ministry of Foreign Affairs website, the Israeli Intelligence and Terrorism Information Center. They say it was Israel that broke the ceasefire and Hamas reacted in retaliation. Israel could now embark on yet another murderous attack in order to foil yet another Palestinian peace offensive. That's the basic picture. And now what's the challenge for us? The challenge is not small. Let me just briefly quote to you from Gideon Levy in Haaretz. The IDF, the Israeli Defense Force, has no mercy for the children in Gaza nursery schools. Compared with previous wars, this one is child's play. It's child's play because of its victims. About a third of those killed in Gaza have been children. The estimates now are the 1,200 killed, about 400 were children. God does not show mercy on the children at Gaza's nursery schools, and neither does the Israeli Defense Forces. That's how it goes when war is waged in such a densely populated area with a population so blessed with children. About half of Gaza's residents are under 15. No pilot or soldier went to war to kill children. Not one among them intended to kill children. But it also seems neither did they intend not to kill them. They went to war after the IDF had already killed 1,000 Palestinian children since May 2000. The public's shocking indifference to these figures is incomprehensible. 1,000 propagandists and apologists cannot excuse this criminal killing. One can blame Hamas for the death of children, but no reasonable person in the world will buy these ludicrous, flawed, propagandistic goods in light of the pictures and statistics coming from Gaza. A significant majority of the children killed in Gaza did not die because they were used as human shields or because they worked for Hamas. They were killed because the IDF bombed, shelled, or fired on them, their families, or their apartment buildings. That is why the blood of Gaza's children is on our hands, not on Hamas's hands, and we will never be able to escape that responsibility. Bear in mind, he uses the standard, no reasonable person will believe the ludicrous, propagandistic lies of the Israeli government. But alas, some here in Canada do believe them. Mr. Ignatieff, the carpetbagger from Harvard. He says, Israel has the right to defend itself. Hamas is a terrorist organization. Israel kills 1,200 Palestinians, targets ambulances, mosques, schools, hospitals, drops white phosphorus indiscriminately in civilian neighborhoods. But Hamas is a terrorist organization. Israel has the right to defend itself. But Palestinians have no right to defend themselves. Palestinians don't even have the right to live. I know some of you are not aware of that because you haven't read the Geneva Conventions. But it's there. You have to search hard, but it's there. Everybody in the world has the right to live, but the people of Palestine do not have that right. Israel has the right, with the support of the United States and the European Union, to put a brutal blockade on Gaza. Before the ceasefire was over, Mary Robinson, the former High Commissioner for Human Rights, she went to Gaza. She says, I can't believe what I see before my eyes. An entire civilization is being destroyed. But Gaza, the people of Gaza, they have a moral responsibility, a legal responsibility to commit collective suicide. They have no right to resist, no right to defend themselves. Only Israel has a right to defend itself. Israel is building a wall which is robbing the Palestinians of 12% of the West Bank. The entire international community, apart from the U.S. and Israel, have declared the wall illegal. The International Court of Justice, the highest judicial body in the world, declared that wall illegal. But Palestinians have no right to defend themselves when 10% of the 22% of their homeland that's left is being stolen before everyone's eyes and despite the ruling of the highest judicial body in the world. Only Israel has the right to defend itself. Bernie Farber, the head of the Canadian Jewish Congress, he issued a statement. He's appalled. He's shocked. He's filled with repugnance, disgust, because he saw a demonstration and an Israeli flag was being burned. But 400 Palestinian children incinerated. That doesn't concern him. Only an Israeli flag being burned in a demonstration. Then come along these human rights organizations, like Amnesty and Human Rights Watch, and they babble and babble and babble some more about whether or not Israel's response was disproportionate. There's a massacre occurring before our eyes, and they can't figure out whether or not it's proportionate. It's as if a Sherman tank were to crash into a playground, blowtorch the children in the playground, and Amnesty and Human Rights Watch are pondering, was that proportionate? I say, what right does Israel have to use any force against the Palestinians? If it doesn't want rockets coming its way, there's a simple solution. Join the rest of humanity. Join. Join the 164 nations in the United Nations General Assembly. Join the International Court of Justice. Join the Arab League. Join the Palestinian Authority, so-called authority, and the Hamas, and withdraw from the territories which you are illegally occupying. Then come the Europeans, the British, the French, the Germans, and they all go to Gaza. And they all meet with Mubarak, and they meet with Olmert. And why are they meeting with them? We have to figure out ways to prevent weapons from being smuggled to Hamas. Now, you have to savor that. You really do. Israel has now just committed a massacre in Gaza. Israel has incinerated the people of Gaza. Israel has committed massive war crimes in Gaza. So what do we have to do? We have to prevent Hamas and the Palestinians from having weapons. Israel commits the massacre. So what do? We have to disarm Hamas. Why? Do Palestinians have to be completely disarmed? Were they not satisfied with the killing ratio of 100-1? Should the ratio be 1,000-1? Is that why they want the Palestinians to be completely disarmed? That's the sad part. I would say the comical part. Were it not for the fact that in my mind's eye, as I think in the mind's eye of many of you, is imprinted those pictures, those horrifying, ghastly pictures of those children who were incinerated. But there's hope, I think. There's grounds for hope. It was alluded to in the remarks, the introductory remarks of one of the people here. He said, when Israeli generals, those heroic, courageous generals, who have now restored Israel's deterrence capacity by committing a massacre among the defenseless, when they come to college campuses, 20 people turn up. And when those who oppose the horrific crimes being committed by what's becoming a satanic state, when the people come to oppose it, there's a significantly larger turnout. The fact of the matter is, Israel prepared very hard, not just for the military side of the war, but for the propaganda side. And the first couple of days, they boasted about how successful their propaganda was. You had to read their reports about how this time they didn't have male spokespersons. They sent out females. I guess this woman, Avital Leibovich, I don't watch TV, but I guess that's her name. Ali Abu Nima calls her the blonde bombshell. I don't know what she looks like. They said they were going to send out these females to soften Israel's image. And it's true. The first couple of days, it was working. Israel had everything under control. It's not too difficult to control your press. They're bought and paid for from the get-go. They give prostitutes a bad name. But they had everything. They do. And I want to tell you, and I'm no American patriot, but there's no press more shameful than the Canadian press. It's a fact. That's a fact. I look at some of those editorials in your Globe and Mail, and my innards start to writhe. I don't know where these people came from, what planet they jumped in, they fell off from, what sewer they crawled out of, but really they should go back. There's a serious problem here. But very, very rapidly, it was quite interesting to watch this whole complex, sophisticated propaganda edifice rapidly began to collapse. Abraham Lincoln famously said, "You can fool some of the people all of the time, all of the people some of the time, but you can't fool all the people all the time." And this is Israel's last free ride. Too many people now know too much about what that state is doing. And I have to add, there was in this past war a significant defection among liberal Jews. In my opinion, this is... one of the things this massacre will be remembered as, it will be remembered as the last Jewish war. It will be the last time that world Jewry will give Israel blanket support for its massacres and slaughters of the Arab people. Our big weapon, our most powerful weapon, it's the weapon I think that Gandhi talked about when he spoke about, when he had to give a name to his movement in India, his nonviolent movement. He couldn't find the right words. He didn't like the word passive resistance because he kept saying that nonviolence is very active. It's not passive. If I had time, I would discuss it at some length because I do like a lot of what Gandhi has to say in the topic. So he was trying to find the right word, and I think it was his cousin who gave him the word, which he eventually used. Who knows what the word is? Satyagraha. Satyagraha. And what does it mean?
Tell us.
Okay. That's the good part. It means, he translated as, hold on to the truth. Satyagraha. Hold on to the truth. And I think that has to be our motto. Our most formidable weapons are truth and justice. What's true and what's right. And the other side fears like the plague, dreads those weapons. It terrifies them. Truth and justice. You should read now their what they write in the newspapers. They say, uh-oh, we're in for a lot of trouble now. Because in 2002, when we left the West Bank after Operation Defensive Shield, that was like 700 Israeli massacres ago, in 2002, March and April, Israel still controlled the West Bank, so it could control what people saw when they came in. But now Israel says we have a big problem. Hamas controls Gaza, and they're going to give free rein to everyone to see what we've done. They know what they did. They know all their nonsense about human shields. We did everything we could to protect civilians. We only targeted militants. They know it's all nonsense. They knew it, and that's why they didn't allow any reporters into Gaza as they committed their slaughter. And they knew it and know it, and that's why they're terrified now what the world is going to see. The aftermath of their operation cast lead. They're stupid names they come up with. Why not just call it what it is? Operation Genghis Khan. You know. The writer Herzen, the Russian writer, he once described modern states. He says, modern states, they're basically Genghis Khan with a telegraph. And Israel is basically Genghis Khan with a laptop. That's what that state, that satanic state, has turned into. Our weapon? Stick to the truth. Don't deviate. And try hard. Try as hard as you can to control the anger, to control the fury, to control the indignation. And I know it's a hard thing to say. Try hard to be reasonable, to stick by those elementary principles of justice, because that's exactly what Israel fears. It doesn't want the other side to be moderate. It doesn't want the other side to be reasonable. It wants to be able to say, we have no one to negotiate with. We have no one to talk to. And our job is to keep saying, we'll still talk to you. We're still ready to negotiate. You're the obstacle. You're the problem. You're preventing the peace. That's the facts. That's the truth. And I think I remain confident. I'm pretty old-fashioned about these things. If we learn to wield the weapons of truth and justice, and it's not so easy to learn how to wield them. You have to do a lot of hard work. You have to be conscientious. You have to organize. If you learn how to wield those weapons of truth and justice, I still believe that despite all the money that the other side has and all the power that they have, and despite all their ruthlessness, I still think if we learn how to wield those weapons of truth and justice and show a little courage, not a lot, we're talking about a little. This is Canada. No. I don't mean that in a pejorative sense. It's a relatively free society. It is. We should be honest about that. In Canada, in the United States, if you speak out, you tell the truth, you know, you may lose your job. I wasn't happy. Let me finish. I wasn't happy. I lost my job. I'm given to self-pity. I save it for my friends. That's why they're my friends. But then a good friend of mine, who lives in Aceh province in Indonesia, which isn't a pretty place now, he says, Norman, remember, in the bigger scheme of things, what happened to you, it's small change. Here, you speak out, you may lose your job. In most of the world, in places where many of you come from, looking at the audience, you speak out, you lose a body part. You lose your tongue, your nose, your ears. You lose your head. You lose your life. So we're not talking about big sacrifices here. Show a little courage, relatively speaking. Learn to wield those weapons of truth and justice. I think we can win. I do. I'm confident of that. There was a famous labor organizer at the beginning of the 20th century, a guy named Joe Hill. He's very famous. There was a song, I Dreamed I Saw Joe Hill Last Night. How many of you know it? No one figures? Okay. No, you're a new generation. Empty generation, but a new generation. And he was a labor organizer. He was framed on murder, on a murder charge. He was executed. And his famous last words were, "Don't mourn, organize." I don't really agree with that entirely. There is a place for mourning. I'm no hero, and I don't say it for all of you, say, oh, yes, you are, yes, you are. I'm not. I know that. I know that. I don't have the courage it takes, the courage it took for many of the people of Gaza. I don't have it in me. I know that. And I love life. I cling to life. I have morbid fear of death. I do. I admit it. And I know when my parents were dying, I clung to their every breath. I would do anything I could to keep them alive for 3 more seconds. Life is beautiful. Most of us cling to it. 400 children in Gaza, they were snuffed out. Snuffed out for what? Because they don't want to live deprived of food, deprived of medicine, because they have this weird idea that they have a right to live. And their lives were snuffed out. We should mourn their deaths. I mourn their deaths. After a certain point, I couldn't even look at the pictures anymore. I just told my website manager, put it up. I don't even want to see it. So I don't really agree with Joe Hill. There is, as the song, you know, from the Ecclesiastes, there's a time and place for every purpose, and there's a time to mourn. And we should mourn. But after we mourn, then I say we have to organize, 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 and finally put a stop to that lunatic state. Thank you.